The next case in our calendar is 00505, Farm Credit Services of Mid-America versus Roger Tracy, Tax Commissioner. Mr. Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Farm Credit Services of Mid-America is a member institution of the farm credit system. It's a federally chartered, federally regulated lending association whose sole function is to provide low-cost, adequate credit to American farmers. Farm Credit Services was formed in 1989 as a result of the merger of predecessor entities that one group were called Federal Land Bank Associations, the other group were called Production Credit Associations. The distinction being that the Federal Land Bank Associations provided long-term secured real estate mortgage loans to farmers. Production Credit Associations provided operating loans that would be for fertilizer or seed for a growing season. Now, unlike a number of the other institutions that are authorized through the Farm Credit Act, the Agricultural Credit Associations do not carry a statutory designation as a federal instrumentality. However, as the Indiana Tax Court and the Indiana Supreme Court observed, that seemed very clear to them that it is a federal instrumentality for a number of reasons, including the fact that it was formed by the merger of entities that did carry such a statutory designation, that its federal charter designates it as a federal instrumentality, and it performs the function which the United States Supreme Court has said is a function appropriate to a federal instrumentality.
Counsel, in the Indiana case, they ultimately concluded they split the baby.
They did.
The land bank, the part had been tax exempt, and PCA part had not. And so they made a determination. And that was at the time of for the tax years in question, where were you at that
point? I'm not sure.
Okay, the Federal Land Bank was merged in 89.
Right.
Okay, so that's prior to the tax years in question.
Right. The years before it was 1993 and 1994. What the court basically did, I think, is said two things. One, they said
you're arguing that entire amount should be.
We believe that the entire amount, all of the income, is exempt. But we would also submit that the minimum exemption that the court should find is the same exemption that Indiana gave Farm Credit Services in America, which is the long-term side.
And is that evidence in the record? In other words, is there an accounting that would enable that result to be carried out?
In the record, as it stands right now, no. So the separation is not made.
So if we were to agree and follow the reasoning of the Indiana Supreme Court, we would need to send this back.
The appropriate remand is to the Board of Tax Appeals for a confrontation, which is exactly what the Indiana Supreme Court did. They remanded to the Indiana Tax Court. It does turn out that those numbers are readily available because they're provided to the Internal Revenue Service.
Counsel, interestingly enough, though, as the dissent in Indiana points out, this was a result that was crafted by the court and really apart from anything that was argued to them by the parties, and that would be the case here as well, isn't it?
It would be the case here, and of course, we don't agree with the Indiana Supreme Court's decision.
Right.
Either with the reason or the result, we think that what the court did was took some dicta from the Farm Credit Services Central Arkansas case, and from that concluded that the court, sub silentio, had basically overruled 180 years worth of precedent. And frankly, that's what they did. Now, as the court is aware, a related case, Cobank versus Missouri Director of Revenue, is currently pending before the court. It was argued in November, and a decision will come down, and of course, we'll make that decision available before the year. That deals really with the question of whether the kind of operation of lending is co-bank does is exempt, and it's related to this case, but it's not controlled. But the one thing in the Indiana case that we do agree with, and I believe we made this point in our briefs, but if we didn't, sure, is that the statute which authorized the formation of the agricultural credit associations says nothing about the taxes. It is completely silent. 2279C1 simply says that the agricultural credit association succeeds to all the powers and all the obligations of its constituent entities, so that we would agree that if there were a statutory waiver of immunity on the short-term side, there's clearly none on the long-term side because the federal statute, the Federal Farm Credit Act, provides statutory immunity on the long-term side. But if there is a statutory waiver on the short-term side, which has been argued in a number of cases, in the Mexico case, for example, if the court were to conclude that there were statutory waiver on the short-term side, the old PCA business, then we inherit that waiver, then we would be taxed.
By waiver, you mean that because they did not indicate immunity or taxation, that's impliedly a waiver.
Not
to taxation.
I mean, our argument is the other way around, as it has been since McCullough. There is immunity absent a waiver of immunity, or perhaps I should use the word an authorization of tax.
There remains today a waiver or an immunity expressed in the federal statutes for long-term obligations.
Right. The statute with respect to federal land bank associations, of which there are still some around, there are none in pile, but specifically states that the federal land bank associations are exempt from state taxation except real property taxes. It's been there since 1916. There is not a comparable statutory exemption with respect to the Agricultural Credit Association. There had been one up until 1985, the Pennsylvania Appeal. And the argument I hope I'm not confusing you if I refer to
but the state's position is that it's all taxable, including the long-term obligations at this point.
Their argument is, in effect, that there has to be a statutory exemption for a federal instrumentality to be exempt from state taxation. And I think the Indiana Tax Court said that as well as anybody. They said that turns the rule on its head.
How would your institutions differ from federally chartered banks?
Well, obviously our function is somewhat different, but in terms of our status as state taxpayers, frankly, we are comparable because the United States Supreme Court has said repeatedly, most recently in the Berkshire case, that the federally chartered national banks, are taxable by the states only as authorized by Congress. Absent congressional authorization, a national bank is not taxable. It just happens that now, in about 1970, Congress authorized states to tax national banks, and the statute basically says in the same manner as state banks.
Yeah, but they also have statutory charters, and you don't. Under the theory that if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. Here we have a private corporation lending to private individuals owned by private people without a statutory charter. How can that be exempt from taxation?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand what you're saying when a national bank is going to have a statutory charter. I mean, a national bank is privately owned, in fact, publicly traded. It deals strictly with private individuals. It no longer has any function as part of the Federal Reserve System.
But it's authorized by statute.
Sure, and so are we. The Agricultural Credit Association exists solely because Congress authorized it, and it has only those powers that Congress authorized. We are purely a creature of federal statute.
But doesn't the federal bank have a charter?
Yes, as do we.
You have a statutory charter?
We have a statutory charter. It's the Farm Credit Administration is authorized to grant a charter. And the record in this case includes a copy of our charter, which is, and it's included in the supplement filed with our opening brief in this case. We really are. We are more than happy to be paired with the national banks. Federal savings loans, the rule is the same. Federal credit unions, the rule is the same. These entities are federal instrumentalities, and they are taxable by the states only if Congress has authorized such taxation. That's And frankly, until the Indiana Supreme Court decision, we cite all these cases, there have been, I think, maybe a dozen decisions involving the farm credit system. Every one accepted that opening premise. Even the dissenting opinion in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, Justice Logan's dissent, in the case that was subsequently reversed on jurisdictional grounds, his opinion starts out by saying, and this deals with the farm credit system, starts out by saying that these entities are federal instrumentalities and they are exempt from state taxation unless Congress has authorized such taxation. He then goes on to find that authorization. But the premise, when I was in law school, we talked about black letter law. This is black letter law. We're talking about 180 years. And while there have been decisions which have ruled that certain kinds of entities, federal contractors, for example, are not federal instrumentalities, as the Mexican case, there's never been a case decided by the United States Supreme Court where an entity that is accepted as a federal instrumentality has been found to be subject to state taxation, absent congressional authorization. This all comes down to the fact that these entities are created by Congress and they are taxable only as Congress permits.
Prior to the merger, was the short-term business being taxed by states?
Yes, the Columbus Production Credit Association case in this court is an illustration of the state of the law.
That was based on a specific authorization.
Specific statutory authorization. And the court's decision starts out, as all the decisions do, that the Federal Credit Association, federal instrumentality.
And that authorization still exists.
That's what was repealed.
That was
1985. And so that's the issue which was litigated, for example, in New Mexico, as well as Arkansas. But that authorization was repealed, and the states have argued that, it was repealed kind of as a housekeeping function. I submit that if you look at the history in 1985, that's
so that we,
you know, does not assume that
Congress framework, really the statutory framework with respect to short-term lending is now silent.
It is silent with respect to the entity. There is still an statutory exemption for obligations issued by production credit associations. They've raised their money by issuing bonds. That is still there. And the Supreme Court explained, though, in this one case, which is cited in our briefs, that is a completely separate exemption from the exemption attributable to the entity and its income. That exemption exists because, absent a statutory exemption, the obligations, which could go to you or me, we could buy them and hold them, would not otherwise be the same.
Is there statutory authority for the merger, or is that as done in the economic reality? Was there statutory authority for the mergers, or is that done in the economic reality?
The mergers were statutorily authorized. They were not mandated. Though, of course, my clients would tell me that they really were mandated because the entities were obligated, if they serviced contiguous areas, to go to their members and ask for merger authorization. Well, a business person would tell you, you've got to go to your members. You're not going to say, gee, Congress says we should merge, but we don't want to. The 2279 authorizes those mergers. And again, what it says is that the resulting entity inherits, succeeds to, all of the powers and all of the obligations. So So our view is, and we agree with Indiana to this extent, you need to look at the status of the Federal Land Bank Associations and the Federal Credit Association. And we simply inherit whatever their state tax liability or immunity is. We, of course, would argue that they are immune, and that certainly has been the vast majority of the cases that have been decided have come down on the side of immunity, because those courts have not been able to find, with the exception of New Mexico, statutory opposition.
Are there any Federal Credit Associations still standing free?
Yes, not in Ohio, but yes, in the state.
What is the state of taxation?
Well, if that's a matter of litigation, the Arkansas Supreme Court said that they were exempt. The Louisiana Court of Appeals said they were exempt. Kansas Court of Tax Appeals said they were exempt. New Mexico Court of Appeals said they were tax exempt. So,
none of those issues have gone up yet to the...
No, but they haven't gone to the Supreme Court, but the case that's currently pending involves roughly identical statutory provisions, so it's probably a principle that piece is fine.
Is there a reason why we should wait for that decision?
Oh, you can expect it in about 6 weeks based upon the course of normal practice. So we'll certainly be sure you get it as soon as you get it out.
You were chartered by the Farm Credit Administration.
Right.
And yet through that, you call yourself a federally chartered
instrumentality.
Is there any indication, any place that Congress ever authorized that the administration could in fact permit you to call yourself a federally chartered instrumentality, given the fact that it was the Farm Credit Administration that had certified you?
Well,
that's what I was talking about, a statutory charter, a federal charter. It seems to me that it breaks down there someplace.
Let me see if I can just crack through. I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question, but Congress authorized the creation of these entities.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And no entity can exist as part of the Farm Credit System absent congressional authorization. They either authorize you or you don't exist. Two, they authorize the Farm Credit Administration, which is an independent regulator, an independent agency of these entities, to regulate the Farm Credit System, including the authority to issue charters.
So you think vicariously or by osmosis or something, it becomes a statutory charter, if you will, or a congressionally authorized charter?
Well, I think that when you look at the fact that all of the constituent entities have the statutory designation,
mm-hmm.
and you look at the circumstances in which Congress was, what it was reacting to in 1987 when they authorized these things, which was a farm credit system that basically broke. And the Indiana Tax Force said this. They said it seems impossible at best that Congress would somehow intend these entities to have a different and more onerous tax status than the entities that are being merged when the goal is to try and save the system.
So then the analysis, in your judgment, stops there. It doesn't make any difference that you go on and say that it's loans to private people, is owned by a private entity, and is operated by private people.
Right. That's equally true of, as I said, the national bank, mm-hmm. savings and loans, credit unions. It was more or less true in the Second Bank of the United States, which was the starting point.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to address some of the points that have come up on the prior discussion. I think it would be correct to say that the mergers are authorized by statute. What is absent is any congressional designation, that is, any pronouncement by Congress that, in fact, is a merged entity to be regarded as a federal instrumentality. That is present in some of the other banks in the system. But that's an interesting point. But either there,
if those two entities unmerged, are they federal instrumentalities?
Well, they're actually in various places pronounced to be federal instrumentalities by statute.
Okay, so would you make the logical assumption that separately they are?
There might be a pass through, and that brings me to the second point, that even if we call them instrumentalities, and even if Congress calls them instrumentalities, the dicta, the United States Supreme Court in 1997, considered the case Arkansas versus Farm Credit Services of Central Arkansas, Now, that case is ultimately disposed of on jurisdictional grounds. The U.S. Supreme Court decided that the Tax Injunction Act had prevented them from bringing suit in federal court. So they did go ahead and actually rule on the merits of the case. But the merits question had been certified. It was fully briefed and fully argued. And in dicta, the court said, quote, tax immunity is a permitted consequence of an entity's status as a federal instrumentality and can enjoy the benefits and immunities conferred by explicit statutes without the further inference that they have all the rights and privileges of the national government. So the thinking and the reasoning of the U.S. Supreme Court the last time around was that it strongly points in the direction that there's no presumption of automatic immunity. So it's one of those to look at this case and say, which way does the presumption work? Do we presume immunity until we see Congress say otherwise, or do we presume there's no immunity until we see Congress grant?
Well, is it different from the national banks, the federal charges, say, loans, in how that works?
Yes.
Because it's been argued that there is some U.S. Supreme Court precedent saying they are taxation unless there's a specific authorization.
It's very similar in the sense that there's private ownership in those banks. It's different is that they have statutes that clarify whether or not they're immune. In the Berkshire, the first agricultural national bank case from the 1960s, the United States Supreme Court addressed the immunity of the national banks. And under the statute that had existed, the national banks were originally chartered during the Civil War. They were performing functions of which ultimately helped to raise money for the Union to conduct the war. And very shortly after they were originally chartered, Congress passed an act that said states can tax the national banks this way and that way and the other way. Okay, so the statute specifically said the states can do this, that, and the other thing. Now, over a period of years, notably in the Oldsboro decision in the late 19th century and some other decisions, that statute had always been understood in such a way that anything that it specifically authorized certain taxes to be imposed by the states, and anything that wasn't specifically authorized, Congress must have intended that the states could not impose those taxes. And the court specifically, in the 1960s decision that was referred to, avoided a constitutional analysis, that we don't need to go there. We have this statute, the history of the statute, we're going to continue.
So the statute of law is, with respect to the banks, is, they said, unless the tax is specifically authorized under the statute, you can't do it.
No, well, they didn't say that in the 1960s, interestingly. What they said in the 1960s was that basically we have the statute for the national banks, and all we're going to decide is, we've got this, we're not going to change the history of the taxation of these banks and the history of the interpretation of this statute. And they specifically avoided
So they looked at the specific tax and said it does comport or it doesn't. Is that the nature of that decision?
The nature of that decision is because the national banks said the states can impose this kind of tax, we're not going to allow them to impose the other kind of tax because Congress didn't say that they could.
Right.
Okay, but other banks, such as credit unions, federal credit
unions. Seems to me you're both saying the same thing about that. Let me move you to the case that's there now.
Right.
Do you agree that that case is likely to give an answer to controls in this case?
I think that case is likely to give further instruction, probably along the lines that the court has already articulated in 1997. It may not be controlling. The reason, again, lies in the statutes. Okay? As I was about to say a minute ago, if you talk about federal credit unions, there's a specific statute where Congress says they're exempt from virtually all forms of state taxation. So that really is something that helps the court decide this case. In the case pending before the U.S. Supreme Court, what you have is the National Bank for Cooperatives. It later merged with some other entities and became ProBank. But for the years at issue was the National Bank for Cooperatives. And the banks for cooperatives had a statutory provision that directly addressed their immunity. Okay, and that statutory provision historically is the same one as for the production credit associations, PCAs, and that was the case that went up in 1997. sort of the same statutory structure. What that statute says is, or what it currently says is, these institutions are federal instrumentalities and their notes, obligations, and debentures are exempt from state and local taxation. Okay? And?
So the investors don't have to pay tax on
apparently, their
holdings.
Apparently, in a PCA or a bank of cooperatives. But it used to be historically that they had a broader immunity. There used to be a second sentence in that statute before 1985 that said, and furthermore, the institution is broadly exempt from state taxes, including an Ohio corporate franchise.
Your theory on how you get to tax the long-term obligations here, when that specific exemption still remains?
Well, I think the central thing to focus on is the fact that this was a merger that occurred in 1989 and produced a new institution, a new entity with a new charter. That's a page 8 of the supplement that was submitted with the main brief in the case. There's a new charter. The Indiana court was simply flatly wrong in its analysis. It cited some regulations from the Farm Credit Administration that tried to distinguish mergers and consolidations. In fact, by that account, this was a consolidation.
So the long-term obligations that got rolled in lose their tax exempt status.
Well, what lost the tax exempt status? Well, there no longer exists a federal land bank association that has the exempt status given to those associations. It's now an ACA, an Agricultural Credit Association. I didn't put this in the supplement because the Indiana Supreme Court decision wasn't out, and this issue was never presented in this case. But in the record in this case, in the statutory transcript, there's the shareholder disclosure at the time of merger, and it specifically states that the charters of the constituent associations will be canceled if you approve this merger, and they will cease to exist as individual entities. So there's no question but that Mid-America, as it existed during these tax years, is a fully merged entity. It's a new being under this farm credit system. And it has no statute that provides any level of immunity whatsoever. Congress left it fully unaddressed. And so really, the question is different from the McCullough versus Maryland question. In McCullough, Congress hadn't addressed immunity at all. And the court was free to ask the question, does the supremacy clause of the United States necessarily mean that the institution must be immune? The question here we have the Farm Credit Act of 1971. As we can see from this discussion, there are all kinds of entities that are chartered under this act. And time and again, Congress's method was, we'll specify the degree of immunity. It's kind of the opposite of the First Agricultural Bank, National Bank case we were talking about. Congress's method was, we're going to say exactly what institution and what degree of immunity. And then they passed a statute in 87, they authorized these mergers to say absolutely nothing about any immunity for the merged entity. And to put that in context, in 1980, as we point out in the brief, there was an amendment to the Farm Credit Act. They authorized the creation of subsidiaries, these service corporation subsidiaries. That's 2211, Title 12 of the U.S. Code. And at 2214, sure enough, Congress once again comes through and gives us a statute that describes what effect state law will have on the merged entity. They're not the merged entity, in this case, the subsidiary, okay, these new subsidiaries. And it specifically provides that in certain instances, there will be a pass-through of corporate franchise tax immunity. Yet in 1987, Congress authorizes the merger of this case.
Is there a history in Ohio of taxing these kind of entities without express enumerated authorization from Congress to tax?
I believe that the 1962 decision, as well as the PCA decision, did exactly that. Because in that decision, the court read the PCA provision, and it did not say Ohio can impose a corporate franchise tax on PCA. What it says is, it has the language I was describing before. It says, well, there's a broad immunity. When the federal government no longer owns shares, it's no longer immune. And this court was able to say, look, it may not be an express grant of permission, but by clear implication, Congress intended that once the feds no longer own shares, it would be subject to state taxes. The same really is true essentially in this case. We don't have, what's different is we don't have a specific immunity provision to a merged ACA entity before the court today. But what's the same is we have a Farm Credit Act, an amalgamation of all these statutes, and time and again, Congress says, this entity has this degree of immunity, this entity has a lesser degree of immunity, and they say nothing.
So their silence,
means they intended no immunity.
Means that we should infer they intended no immunity.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's particularly
true. Opposing counsel argues that given what was going on at the time of these mergers, forced or encouraged, it would be reasonable for us to assume that Congress did not mean to enable states to impose a tax on crippled institutions that they were trying to shore up.
That's a very, like the Indiana Supreme Court theory, that's a very new theory for these institutions, because in fact, if you look at the record, and I included some of this in the second supplement.
Well, whether it's new or not, it doesn't seem to be
the
reasonable argument.
The central point it goes for the reason. The reason would be that Congress would not want these mergers to be discouraged by tax consequences. But in fact, the shareholder disclosure shows that they contemplated that the merged entity would be subject to such taxes as allows corporate franchise tax. If you review the second supplement, you can see those materials. So in fact, it did not, in fact, sway the merger. And so it does go to the reason why in fact, that's an invalid argument. The standard has evolved a little bit since McCulloch v. Maryland. In the New Mexico case in 1983, sure, it was a contractor case, but the reasoning of the U.S. Supreme Court was this. Tax immunity is appropriate only in one circumstance, said the court. When the levy falls on the United States itself, or on an agency or instrumentality so closely connected to the government that the two cannot be realistically viewed as separate entities, at least insofar as the activity being taxed is concerned. We submit that's exactly the case here, that we have an entity that is not that closely related. It's privately owned, it's in a private lending business. The U.S. Supreme Court in the 97 decision said that about the PCAs. This is a private commercial lending business. They're in competition with other banks. The American Bankers Association doesn't appreciate the idea of this competitor in fact submitted the reason to the Supreme Court. This is not something that's so closely connected to the federal government under any kind of automatic immunity or even a background presumption of immunity. Congress intended where one of immunity is said when immunity is going to be granted in the Farm Credit System. And it provided no immunity, and therefore there is not the Board of Tax Appeals should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Hanson, you've used your time. Would you may take 30 seconds?
2 points. One, if you look at the second supplement that Council for the State referred to in the disclosures to the shareholders of the entities that merged, it says nothing about state taxes. It deals with federal income taxes, which is a completely different issue. But the second point, and maybe the court, maybe we've been clear on this, the case that is pending before the United States Supreme Court should control the disposition of this case with respect to the activities previously conducted by the Drug and Credit Associations, that is the short-term side. It may say something to you about the long-term side, but I just want to be clear on what we see as significant, which is the short-term side. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.